watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
George Bush's announcement earlier this week of an escalation of troop deployment to Iraq sparked protests around the world. Polls showed more than two-thirds of Americans, including those in the military, oppose the escalation. This raises a basic question. What, if anything, legitimizes Bush to take a life-and-death action that most people here, as well as in Iraq, oppose? And why should soldiers obey Bush's rather than the people's will? More fundamentally, why should anyone obey orders they oppose? And a related question, why do they? The superficial answer is fear of punishment. So, if this is the case, how does a minority maintain fear of punishment over a majority? And what is the role of solidarity in this equation? What is the role of other social institutions and forces in this as well? This week on Unwelcome Guests, a wide-ranging selection of material around these questions. I'm Lynn Gary, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren.
I don't know, good horse, as we trot in this dark heat, that Robin the rich is for worse or for best. They take it by stealing and lying and gambling, and I take my way, my shiny black vest. I treat horses good.
U.S. Army Lieutenant Aaron Watada is the first commissioned officer to publicly refuse deployment to Iraq. He's facing a court-martial on February 5th in Fort Lewis, Washington, which could result in 6 or possibly more years in prison. The bulk of the jail time would result not from charges stemming from his refusal to deploy, but from charges of unbecoming conduct based on his public speeches and media interviews explaining not only his reasons for refusal, but which call for solidarity from the American people to create an organized network of meaningful support that will help other soldiers to disobey orders to participate in a war of imperialism, an illegal war under international law. Central to what he said is the concept that soldiers who are sworn to protect the U.S. Constitution have the right and obligation to use their personal judgment as to whether the orders they are given are consistent with this oath. Watada is not a conscientious objector within the narrow military definition, that is, one morally opposed to all armed conflict. If that were the basis of his refusal, he would not be in the kind of trouble he's in. The only excuse the military accepts for refusing orders to fight is that one is following the orders, as one understands them, of a higher authority, a presumed supreme being. Watada does not say he refuses to fight in all wars, or that he rejects armed defense per se. Watada's challenge is so dangerous and so important because he returns moral authority and the obligation to act upon it to the individual soldier and, by extension, to all individuals in society. I'm going to begin the show by playing for you the entirety of his speech at the 2006 Veterans for Peace Convention last August. This speech is, according to the military, one of Ouattara's crimes.
Thank you, everyone, very much. And thank you all for your tremendous support. How honored and delighted I am to be in the same room with you tonight. I am deeply humbled by the company of the other wonderful speakers that came before me. You are all true American patriots. Although long since out of uniform, you continue to fight for the very same principles you once swore to uphold and defend. No one knows the devastation and suffering of war more than the veterans, which is why we should always be the first to prevent it. I wasn't entirely sure what to say tonight. I thought, as a leader in general, I should speak to motivate. Now, I know that this isn't the military, and surely there are many out there who outrank me, and at one point or another, and yes, I am just an LT. Yet, I feel as though we are all citizens of this great country, and what I have to say is not a matter of authority, but from one citizen to another. We have all seen this war tear apart our country over the past 3 years. It seems as though nothing we've done, from vigils to protests to letters to Congress, have had any effect in persuading the powers that be. Tonight, I would like to speak to you about an idea for a change of strategy. I'm here tonight because I took a leap of faith. My action is not the first, and it certainly will not be the last. Yet, on behalf of those who follow, I require your help, your sacrifice, and that of countless other Americans. I may fail. We all may fail. But nothing we have tried has worked so far. It is time for change, and the change starts with all of us. I stand before you today not as an expert, not as one who pretends to have all the answers. I am simply an American and a servant of the American people. My humble opinions today are just that. I realize that you may not agree with everything I have to say. However, I did not choose to be a leader to be popular. I did it to serve and make better the soldiers of this country. And I swore to carry out this charge honorably under the rule of law. Today, I speak with you about a radical idea. It is one born from the very concept of the American soldier, or the service member. It became instrumental in ending the Vietnam War, but it has long been since forgotten. The idea is this, that to stop an illegal and unjust war, the soldiers and service members can choose to stop fighting it. Now, it is not an easy task for the soldier, for he or she must be aware that they are being used for ill gain. They must hold themselves responsible for individual action. They must remember duty to the Constitution and the people supersedes the ideologies of their leadership. The soldier must be willing to face ostracism by their peers, worry over the survival of their families, and of course, the loss of personal freedom. They must know that resisting an authoritarian government at home is equally important to fighting a foreign aggressor on the battlefield. Finally, those wearing the uniform must know beyond any shadow of a doubt that by refusing immoral and illegal orders, they will be supported by the people not with mere words, but by action. The American soldier must rise above the socialization that tells them authority should always be obeyed without question. Rank should be respected, but never blindly followed. Amen. Awareness of the history of atrocities and destruction committed in the name of America, either through direct military intervention or by proxy war, is crucial. They must realize that this is a war not out of self-defense, but by choice, for profit and imperialistic domination. WMD, ties to Al-Qaeda, and ties to 9/11 never existed, and they never will. The soldier must know that our narrowly and questionably elected officials intentionally manipulated the evidence presented to Congress, the public, and the world to make the case for war. They must know that neither Congress nor this administration has the authority to violate the prohibition against preemptive war, an American law that still stands today. This same administration uses us for rampant violations of time-tested laws banning torture and degradation of prisoners of war. Though the American soldier wants to do right, the illegitimacy of the occupation itself, the policies of this administration, and the rules of engagement of desperate field commanders will ultimately force them to be party to war crimes. They must know some of these facts, if not all, in order to act. Mark Twain once remarked, "Each man must for himself alone decide what is right and what is wrong, which course is patriotic and which isn't. You cannot shirk this and be a man. To decide against your conviction is to be an unqualified and inexcusable traitor, both to yourself and to your country." By this, each and every American soldier, Marine, Airman, and sailor is responsible for their choices and their actions. The freedom to choose is only one that we can deny ourselves. The oath we take swears allegiance not to one man, but to a document of principles and laws designed to protect the American people. Enlisting in the military does not relinquish one's right to seek the truth, neither does it excuse one from rational thought, nor the ability to distinguish between right and wrong. "I was only following orders" is never an excuse. The Nuremberg trial showed America and the world that citizenry, as well as soldiers, have the unrelinquishable obligation to refuse complicity in the war crimes perpetrated by their government. Widespread torture and inhumane treatment of detainees is a war crime. A war of aggression born through an unofficial policy of prevention is a crime against the peace. An occupation violating the very essence of international humanitarian law and sovereignty is a crime against humanity. These crimes are funded by our tax dollars. Should citizens choose to remain silent through self-imposed ignorance or choice, it makes them equally as culpable as the soldiers in these crimes. The Constitution is no mere document. Neither is it old, outdated, or irrelevant. It is the embodiment of all that Americans hold dear: truth, justice, and equality for all. It is the formula for a government of the people and by the people. It is a government that is transparent and accountable to whom they serve, and it dictates a system of checks and balances and separation of powers to prevent the evil that is tyranny. As strong as the Constitution is, it is not foolproof. It does not fully take into account the frailty of human nature. Profit, greed, and hunger for power can corrupt individuals as much as they can corrupt institutions. The founders of the Constitution could not have imagined how money would infect our political system. Neither could they believe a standing army would be used for profit and manifest destiny. Like any common dictatorship, soldiers would be ordered to commit acts of such heinous nature as to be deemed most ungentlemanly and unbecoming that of a free country. The American soldier is not a mercenary. He or she does not simply fight wars for payment. Indeed, the state of the American soldier is worse than that of a mercenary. For a soldier for hire can walk away if they are disgusted by their employer's actions. Instead, especially when it comes to war, American soldiers become indentured servants, whether they volunteer out of patriotism or are drafted through economic desperation. Doesn't matter what the soldier believes is morally right. If this is a war of necessity, why force men and women to fight? When it comes to a war of ideology, the lines between right and wrong are blurred. How tragic it is when the term catch-22 defines the modern American military. Aside from the reality of indentured servitude, the American soldier, in theory, is much nobler. Soldier or officer, when we swear our oath, it is first and foremost to the Constitution and its protectorate, the people. If soldiers realize this war is contrary to what the Constitution extols, if they stood up and threw their weapons down, no president could ever again initiate a war of choice. When we say against all enemies, foreign and domestic, what if our elected leaders become the enemy? Whose orders do we follow? The answer is the conscience that lies in each soldier or service member, each American, and each human being. Our duty to the Constitution is an obligation, not a choice. The military, and especially the Army, is an institution of fraternity and close-knit camaraderie. Peer pressure exists to ensure cohesiveness, but it stamps out individualism and individual thought. The idea of brotherhood and sisterhood is difficult to pull away from if the alternative is loneliness and isolation. If we want soldiers to choose the right but difficult path, they must know beyond any shadow of a doubt that they will be supported by many Americans. To support the troops who resist, you must make your voices heard. If they see thousands supporting me, they will know. I have heard your support, as has Suzanne Swift, as has Ricky Clausing, but many others have not. Increasingly, more soldiers are questioning what they are being asked to do. Yet the majority lack awareness to see the truth that is buried beneath the headlines. Many more see no alternative but to obey. We must show open-minded soldiers and service members a choice, and we must give them the courage to act. 3 weeks ago, Sergeant Hernandez from the 172nd Striker Brigade was killed, leaving behind a wife and two children. In an interview, his wife said he sacrificed his life so that his family could survive. I'm sure Sergeant Hernandez cherished the camaraderie of his brothers, but given a choice, I doubt he would put himself in a position to leave his family husbandless and fatherless. Yet that's the point, you see. People like Sergeant Hernandez don't have a choice. The choices are to fight in Iraq or let your family starve. Many soldiers don't refuse this war en masse because, like all of us, they value their families over their own lives and perhaps their conscience. Who would willingly spend years in prison for principle and morality while denying their family sustenance? I tell this to you because you must know that to stop this war, for the soldiers to stop fighting it, they must have the unconditional support of the people. I have seen the support with my own eyes. For me, it was a leap of faith. For other soldiers, they do not have that luxury. They must know it, and you must show it to them. Convince them that no matter how long they sit in prison, no matter how long this country takes to right itself, their families will have a roof over their heads, food in their stomachs, opportunities, and education. This is a daunting task. It requires the sacrifice of many of us. Why must Canadians feed and house our fellow Americans who have chosen to do the right thing? We should be taking care of our own. Are we that powerless? Are we that unwilling to risk something for those who can truly end this war? How do you support the troops but not the war? By supporting those who can truly stop it. Let them know that resistance to participate in an illegal war is not futile and not without a future. In conclusion, I have broken no law but the code of silence and unquestioning loyalty. If I am guilty of any crime, it is that I learned too much and cared too deeply for the meaningless loss of my fellow soldiers and my fellow human beings. If I am to be punished, it should be for following the rule of law over the immoral orders of one man. If I am to be punished, it should be for not acting sooner. Martin Luther King Jr. once said, "History will have to record that the greatest tragedy of this period was not the strident clamor of the bad people, but the appalling silence of the good people." Now, I'm not a hero. I am a leader of men who said enough is enough. Those who called for war prior to the invasion compared diplomacy with Saddam to the compromises made to Hitler. I say we compromise now by allowing a government that uses war as the first option instead of the last to act with impunity. Many have said this about the World Trade Center: never again. I agree. Never again will we allow those who threaten our way of life to reign free, be they terrorists or elected officials. The time to fight back. The time to fight back is now. The time to stand up and be counted is today. And I'll end this with just one last quote from Martin Luther King Jr. One who breaks an unjust law that conscience tells him is unjust, and who willingly accepts the penalty of imprisonment in order to arouse the conscience of the community over its injustice, is in reality expressing the highest respect for law. Thank you all.
U.S. Army Lieutenant Aaron Watata speaking at the 2006 Veterans for Peace Convention. For links on Watata and other war resisters, see CourageToResist.org. Jeff Engelhart, Garrett Reppenhagen, and Joe Hatcher were in the U.S. Army when the war in Iraq began. Like many young working-class men, they joined the military based on the idea of it that is propagated by the military itself, the corporate media, and the propaganda system that passes for public education in America. Once in the military, they began to educate themselves, which led to a complete change in perspective. When the invasion of Iraq was announced, they considered going AWOL, but ultimately decided, for a variety of reasons, to remain in the military and resist ideologically and covertly from within. This effort included their blog, Fight to Survive, which they published anonymously, as well as serving as correspondents for GI Special, an online journal for GI resistance published by Thomas Barton of MilitaryProject.org. Here's Jeff Engelhart.
Our war in Iraq had proven to be excruciating. We had to fight a war on two different fronts. One was against an insurgency that proved to be elusive and deadly. Another was against the army, as we stood openly opposed to the war and became vulnerable to harassment. Some people assume that the American soldiers are a faceless and mechanized fighting force, blindly following orders given to them by war hawks and profit gluttons in Washington, D.C. These soldiers are compared to stormtroopers, marching through obliterated towns in an ever-expanding empire, unfeeling, uncaring, their rifles aimed toward the horizon with patriotic fervor and the American flag behind them. U.S. soldiers are commonly viewed as the world police force, killing in the name of democracy. Most think that soldiers do not contemplate the ramifications of their jobs, nor is it their place to question the mission. They have the reputation of wholeheartedly supporting their commander-in-chief and never harboring anti-war sentiments. However, what is commonly missing from discussion is that soldiers are people, inherently capable of thinking individually, and they can easily come to despise warfare while engaged in this bloody practice. It wasn't after I joined the Army that I began to understand what the American soldier represents. Early in my enlistment, I came to despise the weak and callow men of authority, hiding behind their pretentious shields of rank and prestige. I realized that I was low in the chain of hierarchy and came to view the GI as a lowly proletariat without a voice or a chance. Their system was enforced by draconian rules and idiotic regulations, and held together by conformity and fear. Individual thought was not encouraged. Orders were passed down from a higher echelon and obeyed unconditionally every step of the way. Military life, for me, was stale and rigid. I felt surrounded by herd mentality. To preserve a different state of mind, something I consider me, I began to educate myself on U.S. imperialism, along with our friends in our platoon. We shared a lot of literature that was considered radical, and it floated around endlessly. We saw U.S. imperialism in the history of hegemonic control over the world. And I saw the Army for what it was, a powerful militant arm of a corrupt and ruthless government, literally the crack at the end of the whip. I was just another cog in the war machine, but I knew instinctively that in their world, knowledge was power. Soldiers have a very limited freedom of speech, one that hardly exists at all. The ironic aspect is that soldiers go to war to protect this freedom, which they can never have themselves. This type of hypocrisy catalyzed my desire to speak out against all hypocrisies Americans are faced with at home. It became a personal goal to return home and help the public to understand the truth based upon what I had experienced. I discovered that we were all tied in this war in one way or another. Every day, we pay the price to fight a war based on ideals that are against ourselves and others across the globe. When understanding this price, the conclusions are truly petrifying. We can try to omit the details of horror, or we can pursue this fight under the guise of false banners, but in the end, we will only destroy ourselves. Some argue that war is basic human attributes, and consequently, there will always be strife. I do not believe this to be true. Even in urban combat zones of Iraq, I saw people who are not my enemy, but people who believe in love and beauty and life like anyone else in the world. Human beings were never meant to wage war against each other. It was only the forces of corrupt power that persuade the masses to sacrifice their lives to jaded exaltations of God and empire. Modern man has certainly developed the intelligence and conscious capacity to find peaceful solutions to any problem, but only if that effort is made to the fullest. The responsibility to ensure peace and justice in the world lies with all of us. No longer should we trust in fraudulent politicians to lead us into prosperity, nor pass the liability on others for that future generations. No matter if we're veterans, activists, punks, peace freaks, tree huggers, commies, or conservatives, the walls of social differences must be removed and a broader task undertaken. This is our world, and by all means, we should fight to take it back.
An article from Fortune magazine dated January 12th, written by John Berger, gives Engelhard's observations of the soldier as proletarian new meaning. It's titled, "Does Troop Surge Mean a Defense Stock Surge?" Berger writes, "Will the planned troop surge in Iraq lead to a stock surge for defense contractors? The short answer is probably not. Yes, defense companies specializing in equipping the troops on the ground will likely get a boost in orders as a result of President Bush's plan to send another 20,000 troops into Iraq. Some likely beneficiaries, armor and body armor makers like Ceradyne and Armor Holdings, Battlefield Computer and Communications Equipment Company DRS Technologies, and armored vehicle maker Force Protection. Among the major defense contractors, the best bet is General Dynamics, maker of the Abrams tank and other military vehicles. The problem is that expectations of a surge are already built into their stock prices. Armor and DHS are up 20% since November, for example. Force Protection is up 100%. The easy money has already been made. And I might interject, clearly, someone else was aware of what was going to happen long before the general public. Continuing, Berger writes, "That being said, there's still a secular case to be made for defense as a sector, one that goes beyond the narrow benefits of 20,000 more troops in Iraq. As much money as the U.S. is spending on defense, the untold defense sector story is the arms race unfolding abroad. Fueled by high commodities prices and rising political unrest, spending on armaments is on the rise all across the globe. And U.S. defense contractors have an edge over their European rivals," says retired Air Force Brigadier General David Baker, now an analyst with Stanford Washington Research Group, "because their products," quote, "have been proven in combat," close quote. That from Fortune magazine's John Berger. The organizational structure of the military, especially in Iraq, makes building a critical mass of dissent very difficult, according to Garrett Reppenhagen.
I think what needs to also be understood about what's going on today in the military and what had happened in Vietnam was the culture, the peer pressure culture of the military lifestyle has changed dramatically. The environment in Iraq, the way the soldiers operate, is very different. There's not a behind the lines. There's no Saigon. There's nowhere a soldier can go where he can put up his rifle and go out to a bar and have a drink. You shower with your weapon. You know, you sleep with your weapon. You know, you're in a small base usually. You know, a very limited area where you're under constant scrutiny of your command. Where it's so micromanaged that a lot of times, you know, you can't go to the bathroom without, you know, your sergeant knowing about it. So it's a very strange environment to try to launch any sort of resistance. The way we did it, it started off very naturally and I guess instinctively. There wasn't a popular movement. Iraq Veterans Against the War hadn't formed yet. You know, great documentaries like Sir No Sir haven't been put together yet. You know, so we didn't really know what we were going to do. We just knew we had to do something. We felt that in lieu of being there, stuck in the situation that we were in and doing the things we were doing and experiencing things we were doing, we had to be some sort of witness, at least to the American people. And I think that's where it started, was reaching out, writing letters to people we knew and starting to organize that way. Obviously, what comes before that is just the awareness that you gain to want to do that. I think we were inspired by a lot of books that we read, a lot of the music that we were listening to, and that sort of helped develop our ideas and just our general backgrounds, I suppose. But now there seems to be a growing movement within the United States, an environment here in America, which is going to help allow the soldiers to feel more comfortable to speak out and to act in a resistance. Now the majority of this nation is against the war and want the troops to come home. While we were there, it was less than 30% wanted the troops to withdraw from Iraq. Bush's approval rating was soaring. You know, we watched in dismay as he was reelected again. It was crushing, and it was a constant struggle under this pressure and this danger of getting caught and receiving UCMJ punishment. The Uniform Code of Military Justice is unlike our legal system here in America. It has an agenda. It has a mission.
And you're guilty until proven innocent, by the way.
You can't have a legal and fair judicial system if you have a mission that's entitled to it. And we realized right away that things weren't going to be fair to us if we were indeed caught and fully exposed. So we went about it with great caution. But I think our ability to resist and speak out launched into a new perspective when we decided to start a blog.
Since completing their terms in the military, Engelhard, Reppenhagen, and Hatcher are active in Iraq Veterans Against the War, IVAW. Joe Hatcher is now the treasurer of IVAW, as well as part of a group, IVAW Deployed, that has been touring the country to educate the public, advocate for veterans, and support GI resistors. They're presently camped near the Fort Lewis Army Base in Washington to support Aaron Watada as he awaits court-martial. Hatcher has come to understand the Iraq War within a context of hypocrisy, passivity, and control within the society generally.
Post-traumatic stress is being claimed by 30% of the returning soldiers right now. And it's because they're fighting in a very closed urban setting and seeing a whole lot in a real short period of time. And at the same time that they're going through a combat situation, they're giving these soldiers Lyrium. Lyrium is an anti-malaria medication that causes psychotic episodes, nightmares, bipolar disorder, loss of equilibrium. And they're giving this to the soldiers in Iraq while they're deployed. And while they're giving the soldiers who are deployed a drug that causes psychosis, they're also sitting them down and providing them with internet and telephones. So you can talk to your family all the time, and you can talk to your friends all the time, and you can put on this machismo facade and, you know, tell them about what you're doing over there and how great it is, and at the same time, you curl up inside your helmet every time a mortar round goes off. So now you've got soldiers who are intentionally dividing their personalities, taking a drug that causes psychosis, paranoia, nightmares, outbursts, violence, and leaving them in a combat zone. And now we're trying to figure out why they're coming home with problems. And since they're coming home with all these problems, like bipolar disorder and other things that, you know, aren't normally assessed to, you know, post-traumatic stress, they're writing these kids off as having personality disorders and bipolar disorder. And instead of giving them the treatment they need, they're giving them a dishonorable discharge for having a personality disorder and enlisting with it, quote unquote. Right now, we also are dealing with depleted uranium. Depleted uranium is basically, according to the EPA, nuclear waste. It's 1.7 times heavier than lead, though, so it punches through a whole lot of things. But when it does punch through it, aerosols in a tiny, itty-bitty little nuclear explosion. And this aerosol, this dust from depleted uranium, is what's causing all the cancer and birth defects. The radiation levels in Baghdad are 1,600 times normal. When parents have a child in Iraq, they don't ask if it's a boy or a girl. They ask if it's normal. I mean, amazing amounts of radiation over there. and it's all the time and everywhere. It's a dry, arid climate. It's dust storms constantly. If you think that depleted uranium dust isn't just floating around there everywhere, you'd be wrong. I mean, I spent an extra month in Kuwait at the end of my deployment cleaning the dust off the vehicles to make sure that the depleted uranium didn't come back to Germany. They were too concerned with me. But the dust wouldn't make it back to Germany. And these are just veterans' issues. This is just a very tiny portion of what's going on right now. And we're fighting in a public where things like cynicism and apathy are the coolest things you could possibly be doing. I mean, emo is the modern equivalent of new wave, and how the hell did that happen? I mean, we need to focus our direction here. We need to understand what we should be doing to invoke change in a society where 70% of the population is saying that we need to be out of Iraq, but the decider, which is still not a word, is just going to keep us there on his whim, because that's what he wants. And the public is content with this. They sit idle in their Starbucks and behind the wheel of their H2, and they're completely unconcerned with what's really going on. They play lip service to the veterans and soldiers by throwing a little yellow bumper sticker on their car. And I'm sure the 6-year-old that made that in China really appreciates it. We live in an apathetic society. We live in a situation where we've let ourselves just be controlled by our government. I mean, in France, they rioted for 3 months straight because, what was it, 2 kids were killed, and then they proposed not raising the minimum wage. They live in a system where the government is afraid of the people, not the people being afraid of the government. And we're in a situation where we're scared shitless of the government. And we have no control, and we have no ideas, and we have no balance, and we affect no change on what's going on in our own society anymore. And the direct result of this is the hundreds of thousands of innocent dead Iraqis, the near 3,000 dead Americans. I'm sure it's over 3,000, because we don't count the people that die on the way out, or that die at Walter Reed, or that die in Germany. They're not on the killed in action list. They don't count.
Joe Hatcher, IVAW. And speaking of the Catch-22, if the American people took to the streets, as did the French, who would be there to execute the clampdown? The military? Would they gun down their own people in the streets? It has happened before, in my lifetime, in this country, not to mention elsewhere on a daily basis. These are some of the contradictions implicit in GI resistance. And this is why Aaron Watata's message is so dangerous. It might lead to a military that would side with the poor in the street rather than the rich in the suites.
This is a song just about the stuff I learned when I was in the military, because recruiters are always pushing education. So this is a little thing I'll tell you about what I got educated to. Sideburns, cut my hair, shine my boots to look like a cog in a machine. I learned to salute people wearing shiny pins on their uniforms. I learned to say yes sir and yes ma'am, and to never ask them why. I learned unquestioning obedience to authority. I learned homophobia, misogyny, and racism are cool. I learned that Arabs are subhuman, and that they deserve to die. I learned to assemble and maintain weapons of mass destruction. I learned that I was property of the state. Trying to remember the next line. march in unison with 60 other gentlemen to be a slave of Uncle Sam, give up my rights and be a man. And they told me, don't even think about quitting, 'cause if you try to leave, this gang will find you and throw your ass in prison. We've done it before, I learned a few things when I was in the military. I learned a few things when I was in the military. Now I must say, sir and ma'am, the military is a scam. Tell your children not to join these terrorists of Uncle Sam. Now I must say, sir and ma'am, the military is a sham. Kick those sleazy recruiters out of the schools. Oh, the generals to hell. Oh, the president to hell. Of the media who glorify militarism. Politicians are full of shit, and the troops are rolling in it. Fuck the war, of the state, fuck authority. I learned a few things when I was in the military. I learned that the troops ain't fighting for freedom, and recruiters are full of ish. Yeah, I learned that the troops ain't fighting for freedom, and recruiters are full of ish. I learned that the troops ain't fighting for freedom, and recruiters are full of ish.
U.S. Air Force veteran Tarik Khan, What I Learned in the Military. I apologize to the artist and the audience for the digital manipulation. There are limits to free speech on the American airwaves. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. Last week, our speaker Nafiz Ahmed referenced Gladio, a covert operation by Italian state forces against a large and militant movement of workers and students in the 1960s. It involved staging terrorist events using fascist paramilitary groups and blaming it on the left as an excuse to escalate repression, with tragic consequences, as you will hear next through the eyes of Antonio Negri, a radical Italian philosopher who was jailed and exiled for his intellectual influence over the movements of the 60s and 70s. Negri is co-author with Michael Hart of Empire, published in 2000. Empire is an analysis of contemporary corporate globalized culture as a new form of empire, one without borders, that requires a new form of resistance from what he calls multitudes. I'm going to play the audio of a 2004 video documentary on the life of Antonio Negri by the German filmmakers Alexandra Welz and Andreas Pichler, which I've adapted for radio. The film begins as Negri places a picture of himself behind bars on the desk.
Cioè io mi vedo così, eh? Ah, in quel momento lì veramente ero veramente furioso, proprio veramente arrabbiato.
That's how I see myself. At that moment, I was really furious, really angry. What stupefies me most is how I got out of that situation. That's what stupefies me the most. I really thought, and I have to say this speaks to my merit, that I always had the ability not to lose, I wouldn't say hope, because I don't really know what that is, but never to lose the intelligence to try to understand it all, despite the contradictions.
L'intelligenza di tentare di capire, insomma, le loro contraddizioni. Perché guarda, la maniera in cui mi hanno trattato è stata proprio...
Just look at the way they treated me. And I got out of it on my feet with dignity in the face of all those who accused me of treachery and betrayal. Antonio Negri, A Revolt That Never Ends. A crowd is chanting, "Tony, come out, Tony, come out." Negri speaks to the crowd. Exploitation today doesn't only happen when you're at the factory, but also when you're using public transport, when you're at school, during the reproduction of your family, during the reproduction of society, when you're dreaming. Resistance happens in all of these areas, in all of these moments.
Exploitation no longer just takes place at the factory. Exploitation now takes place when you're traveling to work. Exploitation now takes place during the reproduction of the whole of society.
That's the novelty of this movement of movements, and the reason for its theoretical hegemony over the sometimes heroic and sometimes horrible tradition of the workers' movement.
After more than 20 years of prison and exile, this is one of the first public appearances of the Italian philosopher Antonio Negri since his release. In the 60s, he agitated in front of Italian factories. Today, he is considered one of the leading intellectuals of the anti-globalization movement. In his world bestseller Empire, which he co-authored with the American literature professor Michael Hart, Negri promises the possibility of revolt in a globalized world. This film tells the story of an intellectual who has been admired as a philosopher and visionary and condemned as a terrorist and enemy of the state. In 1979, Negri, who at that time was a professor of political science, was accused of having kidnapped and murdered the chairman of the Christian Democratic Party, Aldo Moro. A state of emergency reigned in Italy, and Negri was further accused of being the head of the terrorist group, the Red Brigades, and of inciting armed resistance against the state. To the Italian public, he became known as the Cattivo Maestro, an accursed seducer of the Italian youth, a persona non grata.
They called me Cattivo Maestro, the villainous professor, because I sent young people into danger. I sent them to get killed and to kill. Cattivo Maestro is a very, very hard judgment, the way the media used it. Cattivo Maestro, who teaches immoral things. Socrates, they said, taught ill-natured things, things that were against the order of society. That is true. He taught them, by the way, as an academic professor, while being paid by the state. I always thought that becoming a professor would mean teaching freedom and exercising freedom. I was wrong. Here you have to teach what the state tells you to teach. It doesn't work like that.
What culminated in the charges against Negri begins in the Venetian industrial suburb of Porto Marghera. Here, Negri finds the main theme of his research and later theories, labor and the struggle against exploitation. In the 1950s, industrialization prompts massive migrations of workers from the country's southern regions to the north, where they live in overcrowded tenements and perform repetitive piecework. Negri and a group of intellectuals, the so-called operaisti, investigate the situation to assess the potential of political action.
Gianni Minardi, activist, Potere Operaio. I remember us going around the country Tony was a man of the people, a man of politics. The tie he had in his pocket would disappear. He held perfect, constructive discussions with people. We worked very hard to prepare the leaflets, because they came out two or three times a week. This was a way to sow the seeds of political action.
Andavo davanti alle fabbriche verso le 5 di mattina. Facevamo riunioni con i compagni che entravano.
We would stand in front of the factories at 5 in the morning. We would meet with the comrades going into work. I stayed until 8, 8:30. From 5:36 until 8, 8:30. Afterwards, I would take the car and drive half an hour back to Padua, tie my tie, and live my academic life.
Negri is a professor at the Institute of Political Science at the University of Padua. There seemed to be no contradiction between his academic work and his political engagement.
Professor of Politics Alisa Del Rey, activist with Potere Operaio.
Devo dire che quello che ha chiesto di più e che chiedeva comunque.
Of all the professors passing through the faculty, he was the most demanding, the one who asked the most of his staff. I remember one sentence that was very offensive. When Tony said, "Frankly, comrade, I don't understand you," then one would feel really ashamed. It meant that we understood certain things improperly or that we had read them wrong. We, the people working on the theory of work refusal, at the time it was regarded as a very high-minded theory. We were the ones who worked the most.
Se io penso alla mia famiglia, no?
Antonio Negri. If I think back to my family, to the development that occurred between my grandfather's time and mine. When I was a child, my grandfather, who was a farmer, used to tell me, "You don't know what an effort it is, these heavy sacks on your shoulders. To do this job all day long, carrying a quintal on your shoulders, it's a job that breaks your back. It's a job that breaks your life." His rejection of this type of labor was what led him to send his children to school, to transform the labor. Seen from the other side, capitalistic control cannot be maintained if people refuse to work.
The group of political activists around Negri call themselves Potere Operaio, or Workers' Power. Workers and intellectuals join forces for political action. Their demands go far beyond those of the trade unions. Instead of only insisting on higher wages, they strive for the abolition of wage labor itself. The freedom to live rather than work in the factory. As the situation in the factories heats up, Potere Operaio gains influence with its radical demands.
Franco Berardi, author and Potere Operaio activist.
Io ho conosciuto Tony Negri nel 1967. Avevo 17 anni. C'erano tre.
I met Tony Negri in 1967 when I was 17. The group was growing in three cities. This professor from Padua came. They said he was the head. The one who's developing the organization Potere Operaio on a national level. I was a student, and I remember that this meeting was very exciting in many ways.
When student revolts erupt across Europe in 1968, the movement in Italy encounters an independent workers' movement that has been organized for years.
From a 1970 Potere Operaio pamphlet, The Refusal of Labor.
It is not true that we are free in this society. We are only free to get up every morning and go to work. The idea that work ennobles is a capitalist invention. In the autumn of 1969, the workers have nothing left to lose. They refuse to work and attack Fiat's assembly plants. Assembly lines are blocked and workers' councils take control. It is the beginning of a conflict that will last for years. Negri Negri takes part in the revolts at the Fiat plant in Torino and the chemical industry in Porto Marghera.
Lo Stato ha capito che la forza del movimento era enorme.
Antonio Negri.
The
state understood that the movement had enormous strength, so it introduced two elements that it always implements on such occasions, public security and polemics on violence. They did this through paramilitary or fascist groups, or through groups close to the police.
A bomb in Milan's Piazza Fontana killed 16 people and injuries countless others. The attack is attributed to the left. Only years later did the truth come out that fascist groups with ties to the Italian Secret Service were responsible for the bombing. The so-called strategy of tension, a series of terrorist attacks, is employed by the right to create a climate of anxiety and insecurity.
Then it went on with armed conflicts, demonstrations and marches. In those years, in Milan, someone died at every demonstration. In 2001, when the young Giuliani died in Genova, everyone was shocked, right? In the 1960s, every demonstration left a corpse in the street. At this point, the movement started arming itself. That meant that when the police fired, the comrades would fire back. So this small Italian civil war began that continued all through the 1970s.
Having become centers of revolt, numerous large factories are closed and decentralized. Factory production becomes automated, and the striking workers are replaced by machines. Massive unemployment and an economic crisis follows. The conflict between traditional unions and radical groups comes to a head. Trade unions respond to the situation by calling on workers to work overtime on Saturdays.
We brought a couple of thousand of mostly young, unemployed people to the factory. We said, if the factory has to work more, here we are. And then there was this confrontation with the trade unions, an extremely hard one. Just to tell you how violence can explode in a situation like this, the following Saturday, the unions called for more overtime, but they couldn't do anything because the factory's electricity had been blown. All of the huge electricity pylons had been sawed through and fallen down. The factory was left without power. I can tell you these things because I've already been convicted of them.
The protest expands from the factories to the city.
E poi che la fabbrica non c'era più man mano.
Negri.
Che la fabbrica diventava
Slowly,
una fabbrica
the factory
sociale.
Ceased to exist. The whole society became a factory. The worker, the one who was producing the surplus value, was no longer a factory worker you would recognize, but was rather someone you would find at school, at home, in the small factory, in public service, someone you saw everywhere.
Negri witnesses the emergence of a new class. He coins the term the social worker, a conceptual precursor to his later theories.
Si apre veramente un orizzonte nuovo.
A new horizon opened up, a new revolutionary horizon. Meanwhile, you had the new movements. Feminism was extremely important, especially in Italy. Keep in mind, these were the years of the laws on divorce, abortion, etc. There were very strong movements, and they changed the way people thought.